This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Ethan Mordden about his book, When Broadway Went to Hollywood, which is a great kind of, I'll call it history, but it's just a great portrait of the relationship between Broadway musicals and Hollywood. And it's comprehensive, but really not all that long and highly readable. How are you, Ethan?
I'm fine.
Well, I know for you, the history of Broadway has been one of your passions. And I'm kind of interested in your own work first. As you're best known as a writer, but early on in your career, you wrote musicals, did you not?
Yes, I was in the Lehman Engel BMI workshop. Young writers who after the first year, would work on musicals, usually with a partner in the class, sometimes not, a partner outside the class. A lot of famous people were in that class, by the way. A lot of Broadway shows, some quite successful ones, came out of that class. And I have a cute little story, at least I think it's cute, because Ed Kleban was one of the people in the class. And the way it worked was you would be working on your own, and then when the class, I think it met every Friday afternoon, something like that, and every week. And you'd get up there in front of the class and you'd perform whatever song you had recently written. And the class would comment on it. They usually had nothing of value to say whatsoever. And then Lehman, with his expertise and seasoning, would weigh in. And that was interesting. And you could learn from that. And so Ed Kleban told us that he was working on a musical with someone who was not in the class. And it was about a bunch of people auditioning for Broadway to be in the chorus of a show. And instead of singing and dancing and telling jokes, they would talk about their lives to the director. And that was what the audition consisted of. And the class know-it-all turned to the woman on his right and said, "That show's going to last a week." And I was wrong by 15 years. But, a chorus line, if you just hear the idea of it, it sounds very strange and unworkable. But all the unique shows are like that. West Side Story and Hamilton, and you just name anything that's really unusual. If you hear just the idea, you think that would never work.
Right, it sounds terrible.
The conventional shows that always sound like a good idea, and sometimes they flop dismally.
Right. Well, but that's what makes it fun, isn't it?
Yes. That keeps the mystery working.
Yeah. And I think there is that sort of odd thing about, I think it applies to almost all art, and that is the absolute inability to predict the new thing and what new thing will be popular. But that takes us, I guess that's a really good lead in to the movies. The movies were in that, the early 20th century, the new thing, the new art form, the new entertainment. And they, as such, they kind of sucked up all kinds of story wherever they could find it. And it was a fairly natural thing, I think, for filmmakers to look to Broadway, where performances, and storytelling were preeminent, and of course also to books. But as you talk about, in that it's sort of the constant theme that Hollywood applies a different set of principles to art than any art form does, which creates this tension.
Yes, this is my theory of the three audiences. This is my own personal theory, and it's based more on the Golden Age, going way back to the 20s, 30s, 40s, and so on, rather than today. I believe there are three audiences, and Hollywood was always very aware that there's the first audience, the second audience, the third audience. You have to capture two at least of those audiences in order to have a hit. The first audience is the sophisticated one, New Yorkers, for instance, and people in California. It's really the coasts, but also perhaps Chicago and the old theater capitals, really. And the second audience is basically the Midwest, smaller cities. They're slightly adventurous, but not so much so. And the third audience is the village America, basically, and the South. And they really like their art well broken in. They're not very venturesome at all. And what's interesting is the great people on Broadway, who did, of course, all venture into Hollywood at some point or other, always were writing at their best for the first audience, which would then perhaps be a hit on New York, and then it could tour to Boston, to Philadelphia, to Chicago, and so on. But they weren't worried about working toward a national audience or capturing the second or the third audiences, whereas Hollywood always wanted at least the first and the second, or the second and the third. And even there's one studio, Universal, that always, this is the 1910s and the 1920s, they always made movies for the third audience. The bulk of the movie theaters that Universal was connected with, the theater chain that they owned, that was all in the South. So that was a very backward studio in that sense. And their musicals were very backward. They're kind of interesting when you watch them today, because they seem incredibly antique next to what Paramount and MGM was doing the same year. We're doing the same year.
Right. No, and I think that I was struck by that, and it made a lot of sense to me. You know, it Broadway, you know, people go to the show who, you know, it's kind of a local, I mean, local event. You know, you go to the show in the city. Now, of course, you have tours, but in that way, it made sense to me what you were saying, that the theater is about people with sophistication and kind of urban, the urban ethos, so that the shows are all from that kind of milieu.
Yes, they're worldly, basically. The people who are writing them are worldly, and the audiences presumably are worldly too.
Now, do you think that, and of course, I think you point out that there's really a fourth leg to this now with the, you know, what you would say was the young audience, the youth audience.
Yes. And that doesn't really fit. You can't speak of three audiences anymore, because it doesn't have to do with people's cultural background, which is what my theory of the three audiences addresses. It's now really a matter of age kind of thing. The youth audience is, you know, completely different in that sense. For instance, one thing about them is they don't really like traditional theater music, and they certainly don't like sopranos hitting high notes. They just don't like that sound. They're not used to it. They know rock, and the closer you are to rock, the happier they'll be. So, for instance, a movie based on a Broadway show like Jersey Boys would be just the kind of thing they would like, although I have an odd feeling that I'm the only person who likes that movie. It doesn't seem to have any kind of following whatsoever. But I love movie musicals that are very, very faithful to the original, to the Broadway original. And although it can't really be, because, you know, staging is, especially nowadays, which is so high tech, is very different from the naturalistic thing you get in a movie. Still, the same people who wrote the script for Broadway wrote the script for the movie. I don't know what Clint Eastwood was doing directing a musical, but I think he brought it off very nicely.
Well, actually, I may be one of the small group of people that likes that film as well. I never did see the Broadway. I didn't see the show on Broadway, so I had nothing to compare it to. But, you know, I grew up in the 50s and loved the Four Seasons, so it's impossible not to like the show, or the film, because it tells her story. But I think that in a way that's even not aimed at a true youth audience, because the music itself comes from an old, you know, maybe from when a current middle-aged audience was young. But
oh, that's true. Yes. But on the other hand, it's the kind of music that the youth audience can appreciate, even if it's completely new to them. Whereas something like, I'm just throwing this out, you know, Victor Herbert or The Desert Song, that, you know, they're just going to reject that out of hand. Not that anyone is going to film, you know, a Victor Herbert show or The Desert Song at this point.
Well, you know what, it struck me as I was reading this book. Now, I've watched a lot of movies in my life. You know, I've been watching movies for a really long time, and I probably have seen more older movies than most people because I like them, you know, and because I grew up in a family that was interested and involved in those movies. But there were so many that you talked about that, well, some are lost, as you pointed out. They don't even exist anymore. But some of the movies you talked about, I don't even remember ever seeing. You know, they're really, some of the movie musicals of the 30s are really obscure.
They are. And in fact, the only time you could see them in an earlier age, they never showed up in revival houses, really. They were so unknown. They would occasionally, though, turn up on Channel 9 or Channel 7 if you lived in New York. And then finally, TCM has started to run them, but only like once every 100 years on a Thursday night at 3:30 a.m. So, it, you know, I, when I earlier I did a book on movies, and I needed to get notes on a movie in which Noel Coward starred, believe it or not. It's not a musical. It's a straight – it's called The Scoundrel. And it's a sort of fantasy. He's very bad, and then he gets a chance to redeem himself. And I really needed notes on this, and it was going to be on, like, Channel 9 or Channel 11 at something like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I just had to stay up. I just – there was the only way I could see it. And I stayed, and I stayed, and I stayed. And finally, the movie starts, and I had my notebook in my lap. And the next thing I know, I have awakened the next morning. It's like, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, oh, no, I missed the whole thing. But believe it or not, I had managed to stay awake through the movie. I had all my notes in my notebook. I just didn't remember any of it because I was so exhausted. Right. But, of course, nowadays, there are all these – first of all, there are tons of bootlegs that you can buy on eBay of, you know, crazy old movies that I've fallen out of copyright or just nobody really cares. Plus, constantly turn up on YouTube. Now, apparently there are copyright police who check to see if something is going on there, and they can disappear very quickly. But on the other hand, sometimes just nobody cares about these obscure things. Some of the weirdest movies that I discussed in the book are just sitting there on YouTube.
Well, I think a lot of it is that the they really aren't – if the copyright is owned, it might be by a studio that no longer exists, and the studio that bought its catalog doesn't even know that they own it.
Absolutely. And plus, it's not as if by running those films, let's say The Dance of Life, what is that, Paramount 1929, you know, no one is ever going to release that. And so it's not as if you're taking business away from anyone.
No, I think that's kind of a wonderful thing. YouTube is an incredible resource for old film and television, things that you just didn't even know existed.
Absolutely. Not just Hollywood, but, you know, all over Europe, all kinds of crazy silent films. I just ran across something yesterday. It was from 1916. I don't remember. It was one of those movies based on a literary work. It was only 30 minutes long and something. It was a silent, obviously. I was just amazed to find it. And early German, for instance, sound films like Die Drei von der Tankstelle and Victor und Victoria, two marvelous movie musicals. And they were up under some kind of false sobriquet. You know, they weren't there under their titles. Some of these things hide in plain sight, say. And I have forgotten what they were listed under, so I haven't been able to retrieve them again. I never did finish watching them.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask you about this sort of period. You know, you talk about the ebb and flow, you know, that initially when talkies first began, you know, musicals were popular, and then, of course, Hollywood does what it does best, which is copy itself and kind of make a kill off the goose that laid the golden egg. Audiences get tired of them because they've seen too many, and then nobody wants to watch a musical. And you talked about the kind of the next wave after the very first wave. There was a kind of revival of musicals again in the 30s. And that's sort of the time when, you know, maybe some of the ones we know best, you know, might, you know, were made, and Irving Berlin was, you know, was hired, and, you know, people came from New York, from Broadway to make, to write shows for Hollywood. And maybe you could, like, if you were someone who didn't know that period well, what film of that era would you recommend as the one to watch, or a couple, if you want to, you know, recommend a couple for people who have not really, traveled through that period of filmmaking?
I would recommend a series, and that's the RKO Dance Musical. Those are the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers films, because the producer of them, Pandro S. Berman, was one of the few Hollywood producers who really loved Broadway music and wanted to welcome all the best composers, best songwriters, and that he thought they were what he needed to set off his two wonderful stars and the crazy eccentrics who supported them, like Eric Bloor and Edward Everett Horton, in their many fiendish tizzies. And the whole idea was to put the music forward so that these two wonderful stars had something to sing and something to dance to that was unusual, that would really stand out. He wanted Irving Berlin. He wanted Jerome Kern. He wanted the Gershwins. If you need titles, the one that everyone loves the best is a Berlin score. That's Top Hat.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone thinks that's the gem of the collection. My favorite is Swing Time. That's Jerome Kern. And I think Dorothy Fields is the lyricist. And there's also a wonderful Gershwin show. It's shoot, I'm, you know, at my age, I'm always forgetting titles now, but it's the one that has They Can't Take That Away From Me. It's a truly, and I've Got Beginner's Luck. It's Shall We Dance? And of course, you always have to understand that the plots themselves are really just a kind of platform for a series of crazy jokes and, as I say, eccentric support, and of course the two sweethearts and their dancing. So it's not as if you're going to get a great story. What you're going to get is a great musical. Of course, that's not exactly the same thing. I did a book on two books on Hollywood at Knopf, and my editor was Vicki Wilson, and pursuant to the process, we would go to revival houses. This was a while back. And take in some of these movies. And so we came out of a musical, and I said, well, what did you think? I don't remember what the musical was. And she said, you know, I really don't like musicals. Just when you're getting into the story, they start singing and dancing. Which, of course, is that's what a musical is, kind of thing. But that's, I would say the Astaire Rogers films, and any of them, really, although Carefree only has three songs in it. But those are, and I don't mean the Barclays of Broadway, which was the kind of comeback Astaire and Rogers. It was at a different studio. That was at MGM 10 years later. The great ones are all the RKOs in the 1930s. And they really are unique films, even though they resemble each other. In fact, Top Hat is like a remake of, I don't remember, but two of them are just bizarrely alike in almost every respect. But the fact is, these are distinctive talents. And there's also a Fred Astaire, not Ginger Rogers film, which is quite wonderful, called A Damsel in Distress. And here you get, it's in England, and it's a P.G. Wodehouse type of thing. So it's a completely different cast besides Fred Astaire. And Burns and Allen, who are very, very funny, are the, you know, the eccentric support. And there are various other people that do various things. The only problem is, they decided to give him not a dancing partner, but a movie star who can not only not dance, she can't sing and she can't act, but she's Joan Fontaine, so she looks great. And there's this one, at some point, you know, he has to dance with his sweetheart. Otherwise, the movie, you know, implodes. So there is one number where they dance together, but of course she can't dance. So he kind of dances around her, and every now and then she takes a step through a brook or something. It's actually kind of amusing to watch how they keep trying to work around her, and they really kind of fail. But it's a wonderful movie. The famous song there is A Foggy Day, and the rest of the line is In London Town, with that wonderful Ira Gershwin line, "The British Museum had lost its charm." It's a great film, and it's very funny. Probably got the funniest script of all the RKO dance musicals.
Wasn't that fairly common? I think you mentioned this, that the, you know, Hollywood needed stars who didn't, I mean, they would put in like Randolph Scott into a musical who couldn't, I mean, he was good looking and, as you know, fantastic looking, in fact, but could not sing.
No, you could do that in a movie because in those days, the movies only lasted 90 minutes. Whereas, you know, on Broadway, a musical lasted more like between 2.5 and 3 hours. So in a musical, stage musical, Randolph Scott would not have worked because at some point or other, he has to connect with the music. Otherwise, he doesn't exist. But in a 90-minute situation, especially since there are two couples, he's opposite Harriet Hilliard, who, of course, then became Harriet Nelson, if anyone remembers the
Nelson. Ozzie and Harriet.
Complete, yes, exactly. Although I think nowadays it's a completely forgotten show because it doesn't come back on any of the cable channels like TV Land. I may be wrong about that. But the point is, you also have Astaire and Rogers in it too. So that, you know, they take up the slack. But the fact is, it's very, very common in movie musicals that only last 90 minutes for there to be a leading man who doesn't take part in the music. Tyrone Power is in a number of musicals at Fox. And in fact, one of them is again, I'm forgetting the title, is Alice Faye, Ethel Merman, Alexander's Ragtime Band.
Oh, yeah.
Plays, of course, a band leader who's caught between pop music and classical music. And it takes the whole movie for him to work out, that problem. And of course, the finale is that he leads a symphony orchestra at Carnegie Hall playing pop music. So we've brought them back together, kind of thing. But the Jerome Power, again, looks great and he can act. He plays the romance properly. He just isn't, not only doesn't sing, he isn't expected to sing. Everyone else is doing the singing. And the movie is half over, and Ethel Merman suddenly turns up, and she's going to help with the singing. So it's not a problem if a leading man can't sing in these musicals in Hollywood, but it wouldn't work on Broadway.
And the other thing I think you point out that I thought was really interesting is the different way that this sort of tension between how the songs are used, that in in movies, they end up being showpieces rather than advancers of the story the way they work in a true musical.
Yes. See, on Broadway, no one has a problem with people bursting into song for various reasons. I mean, it's a musical. That's what they're supposed to do. But movies are more naturalistic. And when sound came in, producers and various others were afraid that if, let's say, the two sweethearts are walking through a forest glade and a romantic feeling is stealing over them, and one of them starts to sing, the fear was that the audience will think, where'd the orchestra come from? You know, where are the players? What, is there a piano somewhere? So that's why they loved backstagers in Hollywood, because then you can always sing because there's an orchestra playing while you perform, or there's a piano playing while you rehearse, that kind of thing. And there's that tension right the way along for decades. Hollywood never quite understood how you can just have people bursting in. They always wanted there to be a reason in real life. The academic word for this is, which I hate, is diegetic. A diegetic number means it's not like Wouldn't It Be Loverly? It's like someone is on stage and performing, or someone is on radio and performing, that kind of right. thing. Or even someone is singing Happy Birthday to You. But they don't like – the Hollywood musical constantly fears the idea that people are just going to burst into song. It's like that moment in West Side Story, the movie, where right at the beginning – you know, the Jets are walking along the streets of New York. They're walking past a basketball court. They even throw the basketball to someone who turns out, by the way, to be Macaulay Culkin's father. But let's not go there for the moment. And then suddenly, you know, the Leonard Bernstein classical crazy dance music, and they burst into dance. And I know a lot of people must have had a problem with that. Not everyone, but some people must have thought, who are these? You know, these kind of juvenile delinquents dancing in the real streets of New York. But, you know, you have to be able to go with it.
But I think, do you think now that we've gotten over that, that you see movies that have song and dance numbers in them, which don't apologize for simply lifting the trope and going with, you know, as, you know, kind of going with it? What was that, you know, the film that was made using Beatles film? I mean, Beatles songs, Julie.
You mean with the Beatles in them?
No, Julie.
You mean Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band?
No, Julie Taymor's Across the Universe, I think it was. You know, where there's no apology made, you know, that the song, that you don't have to worry about the naturalism. And I think maybe that's, I wonder if that's true in movies like Moulin Rouge and, you know, La La Land, you know, they just don't care.
Well, no, even in 1929, the first year of regular sound production, there were plenty of movie musicals where they didn't care. It's always been there, you know, it's always been there. It's always been part of the movie musical calendar, so to say. But still, there was a notable emphasis on backstagers and other films in which they didn't have to apologize. They just, you know, there's the radio singer, and let's have a radio number kind of thing. Oh, we're in a nightclub. Oh, there's the song. And I'd like to present Miss Vava Voom and her song stylings, so that you don't have to worry about why they're singing in real life. They are singing in real life kind of thing. It's always been there, but in the stage musical, nobody cares. And I would say half the movie musicals from 1929 right up to the present have always tried to figure out a way to make it look as though they're singing, because in real life they're singing.
So do you think after World War II, you know, we come to the 50s and 60s, you know, where the culture changes. And do you think that the music, what's different about the musicals of the 50s and 60s then?
Well, the main thing is, by that time, there's a lot less of the backstager. They're kind of getting used to it, but also because there's a whole cycle going on of adapting stage shows into movie musicals, but they're not 90 minutes anymore. They're going to get longer. They're going to be more faithful. Instead of throwing out almost all the numbers, you know, and changing everything around, which so frequently happened in the past, now they're going to be more faithful. Kiss Me, Kate, for instance, Oklahoma, South Pacific. These are, like it or not, reasonable replicas of what was written for Broadway, you know, in the first place. And some of them, of course, became road shows. It became a big event. Gigi played one of the Broadway theaters on 45th Street for a long time before it went into general release. You had to buy a ticket the way you bought it for a show. You would have to sit in, you know, F103. That's your seat. It isn't coming and going the way people like to do and sit anywhere you want in a regular movie house. And The Sound of Music played road shows, I think, for 5 years before it finally went into general release. So by that time, no one cared anymore. The Sound of Music, after all, you know, they're singing because they're singing, sort of thing. 16 going on 17. Those two are dancing in a meadow glade and no one says, where's the orchestra?
Right.
They accepted at that point, but it did take a long while before I think everyone was comfortable with it. And I think there are people today who just think musicals are a very strange form for that reason. But there was the 50s and 60s are marked especially by a strong influx of shows from Broadway that are turned into movies, and they're longer than they used to be, and they're more faithful than they used to be. And if there is an extra number, it isn't written by house composers. It's written by the composer of the Broadway show. There's a new number, for instance, in Maine. Robert Preston sings it to Lucille Ball. That's not from the show. And, I mean, it wasn't heard on Broadway, but that was written by Jerry Herman.
So
I think that was actually in the show when it was out of town. It was cut in Philadelphia.
Do you think that that comes about? I'm just trying to figure out why. And I'm thinking that, is it possible that it's because more people by then, I think sort of harkening back to your audience segmentation idea, that there were more people by then who had who owned record players and would play Broadway cast records. So they were prepared for watching an entire Broadway musical on film, essentially.
Yes, I suppose that's true, because the cast album really was invented in – the American cast album was invented in 1942. This Is the Army was the first one. Everyone thinks Oklahoma was, but it wasn't. Oklahoma was the second one. Oklahoma was the famous one, and that's what everyone remembers. But it was in 1948 when the LP came out that everybody started to buy – they would buy the hardware and then they'd buy the software. And I know a lot of people who were around at the time clearly remember that it was Kiss Me, Kate at the end of 48 and then South Pacific early 40, spring of 49 that persuaded everyone to buy the new long playing record players and start buying LPs. And yes, then the entire nation was oriented toward the kind of scores that we were used to from Broadway, and that made it easier. For instance, My Fair Lady, everyone in the middle class bought that LP in 1956 when the show. So by the time the 60s came along and they filmed it very faithfully, like it or not, although it should have had Julie Andrews, but again, let's not go there. I think at that point, everyone was used to the fact that that's what musicals were going to be. They were going to be from Broadway. They were going to be very faithful to the Broadway album that you had. And they might even have people from the original show, Robert Preston, the Music Man, for instance, or, of course, Henry Higgins, Rex Harrison, and Stanley Holloway in the My Fair Lady movie.
So, kind of then following, and I'm sort of following along with the narrative, after that, you get to this other period, you know, maybe a more modern period where you have shows like Hair and MAME and Grease. You know, I don't know why all those shows had one word titles. That's an interesting thing. But things kind of changed again, you know, as the 60s, the culture changed in a radical way. You kind of then get into what you would consider a more recognizable modern era from the 70s, 80s, 90s to now. Do you kind of feel like Hollywood has done better in this period than they did in the past, or do they still have the kind of problematic issues adapting to the difference between a Broadway musical and a film?
Well, they always will. Not more, not less, you know, given the era. I mean, first there was that terrible era at the end of the 60s when there were too many big, expensive roadshow musicals, and a lot of them weren't very good, or they were so expensive because the spending was profligate that even though they did good business, they couldn't earn back their money. Hello, Dolly was like that. Oh, tons of people saw Hello, Dolly, but they'd thrown so much money away on that ridiculous parade sequence. You know, everyone wants a bigger first act finale. Remember, these are roadshows, so they have intermissions. And the big number before the intermission has to be bigger, then bigger, then bigger. Each one wants it bigger. Finally, it's the biggest, I think, even to this day, it is the biggest sequence ever filmed in the world, in history, that parade in Hello, Dolly. I mean, the last time I saw it for this book, I took notes on each of the, what do you call it, each section of the parade with the floats and the whatnot and the Women's Christian Temperance Union and so on. And it was just amazing. It just kept coming at you. And it really didn't add anything to the movie, quite frankly. It was just big for big's sake. So there was this disaster first, and all these musicals were flopping. And then Man of La Mancha did so badly that that was the last roadshow that we've ever had. There really isn't a big major roadshow anymore, and the roadshow musical was the the central form of the 1960s. So then there was a period when there were very, very few musicals, and we've never really come back from that kind of thing. And also, again, sometimes they're really wonderful. Like a lot of people love Hair; they love the direction. What Milos Forman did with that very odd Broadway original. He of course gave it more story, but more it's the way the camera moves. On the other hand, the movie of A Chorus Line is an absolute disaster. A great show, ran 15 years on Broadway, and they couldn't film it properly. That movie is so wrong in every respect. Not just because it isn't faithful to the show, it's just Michael Douglas as a choreographer. It's just not believable. And why? And Cassie in the show, his former girlfriend, who's now trying out for the chorus, so interestingly done on Broadway. So many really wonderful people. Don McKechnie was the first, but there were others as well. Anne Reinking, for instance. And then they got Alison Reed, and they made her tawdry and unhappy and silly and crashing with her bags into the mud. The whole thing was so misconceived from beginning to end. And such a marvelous show. That's absolutely scandalous that Richard Attenborough, that great master of the movie musical, was given that assignment. Similarly, John Huston directing it. John Huston directed the first musical of Annie as if he not only didn't like musicals, but he had never seen one. The whole thing is just not good. We can appreciate if people who know what a musical is somehow or other fail to execute one well. But to have someone who doesn't know in the first place is just ridiculous. It's absurd.
So are there any musicals of the last, say, 10 or 15 years that you would recommend to someone to go see?
Into the Woods.
Yeah, okay.
I think that's very well done. It's very cinematic. There are wonderful things that the movies can do that the stage can't, and this movie does them. So that works out very well. I think Jersey Boys, because the music is so wonderful, and it's they do find a way to have that narration. The guys in the movie actually do speak to the audience at various times. And it doesn't, I know it bothers some people when people narrate in movies, but it always reminds me of Maurice Chevalier and those early talkie Paramounts. So I love that kind of thing. Plus it's got Christopher Walken in it. He's always fun. So I would recommend Jersey Boys too.
Well,
of course, everyone's going crazy for La La Land.
I want to see it. It looks fantastic in the trailers.
Yes, it does. But on the other hand, it is another one of those, the musical for people who hate musicals. And I reach for my revolver when I hear
that. Well, hopefully it once we see it, we'll find out that it isn't that. I'm ever hopeful.
Well, it's always worth, it's always wonderful to go to a musical that you don't know anything about at all and just let the thing wash over you and see what it's like.
Yeah. But,
I have to say, with Into the Woods and Jersey Boys, I had seen the shows many times. So, the surprise is missing. The only surprise there is to see how they handle certain moments that, the stage had to sort of fudge, because you can't really, for instance, have a giantess clomping around on stage for real. The movie does it very interestingly, because you never, for the most part, you never see all of her. You never quite get, it's a little like, the appearance of the monster in a monster movie. For the first few times that there's a monster sequence, you don't really quite see the monster. They don't do that till at least an hour has gone by. So they do the same thing with the giantess in that movie. But every now and then there's just a wonderful movie that I wouldn't say Sweeney Todd, by the way, talking about Sondheim. I think, you can't have actors who can't sing showing up in a Sondheim opera. That does not work.
Yeah.
I mean, the movie is very well directed, but Johnny Depp just cannot handle that music.
Yeah, no, I think
it really needs a trained voice. It doesn't need an opera singer, but it needs someone who's working on Broadway, let's say, and has a real baritone to use.
Well, that shows you that one of the issues that Hollywood has had with musicals remains, and that is that the necessity to have a brand name star supersedes the need to have a singer. And
there's also that, you know, they never did this on Broadway, of course, but in Hollywood, right from the beginning, they had no problem dubbing people. They kind of liked to dub people. There are even people who can sing that always got dubbed. Eleanor Powell sang on Broadway. They kept dubbing her at MGM in those Broadway melody movies. And Rita Hayworth, everyone thinks that she probably can't sing because she was always dubbed. She can sing. It's just easier for them sometimes to get a professional dubber like Nan Nguyen, those people who just know, let's say, you know, the physics of the microphone, and they can lay it all down, and then all Rita Hayworth has to do is lip sync. On the other hand, Jean Crane was constantly in musicals, I think because she was the movie star who looked like a musical comedy heroine. She not only couldn't sing, she couldn't lip sync. But that didn't seem to stop them. The dubbing, you know, they're very, very comfortable putting non-singers into roles and then dubbing them. The problem was that Johnny Depp wasn't dubbed.
Yeah. Well,
he was dubbed by Johnny Depp. And he cannot handle, you know, there's a mad scene in that movie. It's the equivalent of the end of Act One of Sweeney Todd. You really need the voice to justify the music, and he can't.
Well, it's, you know, that I think that's true. When you see that film, you realize right away that it's not about the singing. It's just
That's not right, because even though you don't need opera singers doing Sweeney Todd, although it doesn't hurt, you do need people who do have some sort of voice working.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking to me about this book. And I just loved listening to you talking about Hollywood and Broadway. So really appreciate it. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've had the great pleasure of talking to Ethan Mordden about When Broadway Went to Hollywood.